on this morning's Off the Ball Breakfast.
We had this.
One thing I'll say about Liam Cahill is that as a motivator, you're not going to get any better. When Liam delivers a speech in the dressing room before, no matter where you are, we were from Waterford and he had us ready to go. So I can only imagine what he's like managing his own before an All-Ireland final.
And we also had this.
How exciting would this be if we were playing South Africa?
Yeah.
The whole world would be watching going, this is incredible. Look at Razzie, look at what he's done. Listen to the shit he's saying. And we would actually be enjoying it all. This is all like...
All right, see you in 12 years, lads.
You can catch everything from this morning's Off the Ball Breakfast elsewhere on the Go Loud app and every weekday morning from 7:30.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Bank of Ireland, a proud sponsor of Irish rugby. Never stop competing.
Brian O'Driscoll, having the July of his life, I think it's fair to say, from Portrush to Melbourne. How are you getting on?
I'm good. I'm not quite Melbourne. I'm Melbourne bound, but I'm not there yet. But I've had worse July. It's a hard sell of work at home. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, it's a tough life. How was last weekend?
It was great. Obviously, Sunday was a bit of a non-event. You know, I think, you know, the whole world had a sense that it was a fait accompli before it teed off. You know, when you're looking at the world number one having 4-shot lead and just the very few mistakes he does make, even with the double bogey on what, 3 or 4, but like he starts with a birdie and you're like, oh well, that's that. He's just, you know, he's going to shoot 3 under, so someone has to shoot like 61 or 62, and that's just not going to happen in Portrush and the Open, is it? So it was a great week. The crowds were brilliant again. Obviously, we have kind of residual memories from 2019 with Shane and that, and so you know, very high expectations as a nation up there probably weren't relived, but nonetheless, it was still a great tournament. And I'm not shocked to see it back on the cycle so quickly, because it just ticks all the box. Like the merchandise queue, I've never seen anything like it. It was enormous. People just couldn't get enough, and all down the swing zone. And I didn't see a huge amount of live golf, in truth, because we were kind of jumping around in and around the between corporate and all that congregation area. So, but you know, it was a great tournament still.
You managed to catch a good bit of the Lions on Saturday morning. What was the setup in terms of seeking that out?
It was fine, because it was, you know, it was a critical mass, you know, right, of interest, of, you know, in the HSBC suite where I was working. They were like, we'll put 2 screens on, you know, not the main screen, but two corner screens. And then there was jostling for a position to get an early seat in there. So it's a tricky one, because, you know, I wanted to hear a little bit of the build up, but then I'm also realized I'm on the clock too. So trying to find a happy medium of, you know, coaxing people over to have a conversation with close to the screen and kind of listening to them with one ear, but actually listening to the commentary with the other.
Yeah, because it's a great cast of characters, I'd imagine, in that environment, but it's not festooned with former Lions players. Like, I mean, Tim Henman, I'm sure, has a great interest in it, but...
And he's very knowledgeable around right, rugby. You know, rugby is a passion of his. He's far from an Anorak fan, but he knows what's going on, and he asks very informed questions. He absolutely wanted to see it, along with a lot of the guests, in truth. You know, and those that didn't want to see it were out on the golf course anyway. So that's nearly always what happens, you know, in that suite, where the morning can be relatively quiet because people are out watching, and then they come in for lunch at 1 o'clock. So actually not a whole lot changed, except those that wanted to see the rugby didn't watch the golf in the morning, watched it, had lunch, and then would have watched golf in the afternoon. So it was kind of, you know, test match. This tour has been strange because obviously the provincial teams haven't been very good, and there probably has been a distinct lack of hype. Certainly, I've felt it, and the conversation I had with people up in Portrush were saying the same. It wasn't just me that felt that, but sometimes it takes a test series for it to properly ignite and catch people's attention. And did it do that properly on Saturday? Obviously, you never turn down Lions wins. They can be, you know, there's been years where they've been like hen's teeth, but at the same time, I don't know if it fully ignited on the back of the game that we saw.
No, it probably didn't. It does present an interesting challenge for Andy Farrell and his coaching staff this week, where you've just come through this facile victory. Everybody is basically saying you're going to win the series 3-0. The conversation has moved on to whether or not the Lions should ever return to Australia again. And yet you've actually got to ensure that everybody stays grounded this week and gets the job done on Saturday. So that's a tricky little psychological piece for Farrell.
It is. It is. And like, in truth, there was a sizable gulf between the two teams. It was certainly far greater than an 8-point victory. And so you sometimes they're good scenarios for a coach to find themselves in, where he's kind of looking at them going, how are we, you know, I don't know what score was it. Was this, they weren't 75 up at halftime, but I can't remember exactly what it was at halftime, but they should have been out of sight. They should have been 3-4 scores. They missed two good try scoring opportunities. They had all of the play. The one concession was on a high ball when looked for all money that Hugo Keenan had it. They were hardly ever threatened by Australia. And then all of a sudden they somehow managed to conjure up an 8-point loss, which is kind of amazing really. And there was some credit to Australia for digging in the second half, but also, you know, enough capacity to criticise his own team into making sure their heads don't swell in advance of the second test, that they didn't do enough stuff well enough in the second half. They didn't manage to hold on to possession, that Australia came and carried with a little bit more vigour and a little bit more intent. And that, you know, if they do that from the off next time out, well, the Lions have to be wary. Sports is amazing. It really is, because for all money, it looks like it'll be certainly a two game series win. And whatever happens in the third with wholesale changes, you deal with that when you come to it. But sport, you know, never lets you get ahead of yourself. And when it is a 2-horse race and the psychology around, you know, the embarrassment of losing your first two games at home and the bashing that, you know, that Australia will have gotten in the media since the World Cup in 23. It can do amazing things to the spirit and to team morale and togetherness and managing to pull a huge performance out of nowhere. It can happen. It would be a surprise still, but it can happen. So I remember, you know, in 2001, we won very well in the first test and we were coasting in the second test. And we should have been 15 points up by halftime and we missed one or two opportunities. And then a pivot moment happened where we were going to score a try and Joe Roth intercepted and went the other end. And the whole momentum of the series shifted there. And they brought the momentum because of a convincing victory in that second test into the third test. And so sport is strange like that. But it does feel hard to see how this Australian team on the back of that performance can turn it around in such a positive way that they would beat a superior team in the Lions, of which there's no doubt.
The Joe Roth moment is a great example. Like, was there ever any inkling of complacency that set in from your standpoint in 0-1? Granted, you're up against a much better Australia team than this crop are up against, but being almost a test and a half up, let's say, does it just creep in completely unbeknownst to yourself?
I don't think so. I can't remember the conversation at halftime, but I remember feeling very frustrated. You know, we split them open, you know, one of our wingers, you know, went ghosting through the middle of their defence, you know, with maybe about a half hour mark. I think we were already 7 or 8 points up at that stage, and I piled through on it, and I was roaring at him, and he never heard me, and it passed for me, and I'm in under the sticks, and that's 15 points, like that's a 15 point margin, and even with an intercept try and momentum that might come later on, you're still 2 scores behind. So it's so vitally important to take your opportunities, even if you're massively on top, because certainly history will show that swing of momentum changed everything. Because we weren't able to convert, and then because they were able to turn it around the way they did in the second half, it can be difficult to wrestle back. So I was looking at this, at that Australian performance. There was a couple of times in the first 2 or 3 minutes where they got a little bit of front football and they showed one or two things. There was a couple of good Lions reads and maybe Tom Lynam didn't quite pick the right pass, but they created something. But other than that, you know, there was hardly anything. They had no advantage line. They'd none of those. No Skelton, no Valentini, no Topu, who I know is playing, you know, to gain fitness to get into the test team. But none of these guys that give you the hard yards that the Lions have been able to eke out. And so on top of that, what you would ordinarily expect and associate with Australian teams is very high skill level. That was missing. They made lots of unforced errors, ball on the ground, you know, poor quality handling. And so, you know, their little multi-phase plays, other than the occasional tip on that got in behind, they didn't really look like they were stressing the Lions at any juncture. And even in the second half, okay, they managed to get a couple of scores, but it was all very controlled from a Lions point of view.
The other thing I'm thinking this week, Brian, and maybe this is just an aspect of trying to maintain a real level of interest in the second test, is that from an Irish rugby standpoint, we've got two real surprises this year. One of them a full-blown surprise in terms of Northampton beating Leinster. The second one a very big near miss at the Principality Stadium when Wales almost beat Ireland. Probably, you know, twice bitten this year before we actually write off the series, right?
That's sport. That is sport. And I've been stung enough times over the course of my career and seen it enough in the last 10 years as a pundit to, you know, to when you least expect it, it comes back to bite you. And any form of complacency or the subconscious switching off or thinking about, you know, what might be as a Lions series winner 2-0 and all of those things, human nature will... You'll fight it as much as you can, but that's going on in the back of some people's heads, I'm sure, where they were so significantly better than Australia. And they will probably say, well, we only played for a half. So if we managed to play for two halves, we should pull these apart. And it should have been 40 points.
Yeah.
Should have scored 40 at the weekend. If you think about those, the McCarthy crossfield kick, the Hugh Jones missed opportunity. You know, that's at least 12 points. And then the catalyst that creates for confidence and belief and pass the stick and you play with freedom and heads drop. So it works both ways. Hype, confidence, you know, drop your head. And that's why you get these big score lines, even at test match rugby these days. So I'm kind of looking at it going, what mentality will the Lions have? Will they have that cutthroat nature? Will they keep their foot on the throat when it's necessitated, because Australia have nothing after this game. There's, you know, a consolation of a test match win in a last series is nothing. Ask the players that were involved in South Africa in 2009, when the series is over in two, it's over. And so you're kind of just, you're playing it out. So they will come with huge intent, and whether they have enough belief installed in them throughout the week and whether there's changes or not, which you would anticipate, will that be the difference between bridging that 8-point gap? Because as I mentioned already, it felt like it should have been 20 points. And I just think that the Lions, irrespective of their selections and who's available to them, just should have too much. Where they're creating quicker ruck ball, they're making a mess of the ruck for Australia. They certainly did that in the first half, and Australia got hardly any front football, and any defensive system in the world that's anyway organised with 3.5, 4 second rucks will be able to stagnate any attack.
We are not 100% sure about the availability of every player this weekend. For example, Joe McCarthy is a doubt, but if everybody is past fit, do you just go with the exact same 23 again?
I think there's something in this midweek game. I think I don't think you all automatically go to the same 23. I think there's a couple of positions. I think you could look definitely at the back three as viable changes. Obviously, Kinghorn plays, I think, you know, obviously Mack Hansen's going to get a run. I would say Freeman, for the probably the most informed player coming into the tour, it hasn't really happened for him. Like, and I feel his frustration because I know he's trying to create things and make things happen. And even the little bit of ball, when he did get some ball in the second half, he looked for a silly offload unnecessarily. And you can see Farrell was irritated up in the box. That's purely just trying to show your hand that you know you are in that. He made this magnificent catch, you know, off the ground at his bootlaces, and then he kicked it out on the fly. It was a little chip and hit chase, went out directly. It just hasn't happened for him. He is a top class player, but I'm really, you know, you're struggling along with him because you know he has so much more to offer than that. And you would hope that he will be given another opportunity because he could blow it open in you know, test two if he gets a few opportunities. But, you know, an opportunity is there and evident for Mack Hansen if he can go well.
Well, James Lowe didn't do Freeman any favours by not passing the ball out wide to him. If he gets over for that walk-in
exactly.
try.
I mean, and we're all remembering he was one of the try scorers, exactly. Yeah. And then Lowe gets ripped, you know, and okay, gets back for penalty advantage. But yeah, that's frustrating. Wingers are strikers. They want to score. They want to get on the score sheet for their team and for their own personal confidence and belief in their ability. It's what they're kind of on the field to do. And it hasn't really happened for him.
Talk to us about Gibson Park and Finn Russell.
Oh, man,
I mean, this
so
is just magic.
So good. Like, just the two of them. They're complementing each other magnificently. Gibson Park's tempo is back to its best. We've seen over the last 4 years, just picking the right options and variety. Very, very good box kicking where it needs be. You know, contestable 95% of the time. And then the quality of possession he's giving Finn and the options that Finn is taking because of the speed of the rook ball and is showing his skill set and showing his time on the ball like all good tens. But then, you know, some touches of magic as well. He's been in exceptional form over the course of the tour, as has Gibson Park. So, yeah, they are a match made in heaven. And you know, you count it with the two Aussie boys. I know that, you know, that Lina was on, had been capped previously, but his first test start, you know, he wasn't given the platform, but also looked a little bit pedestrian in a lot of his kind of option taking. So will Australia change for Donaldson there? Will they maybe bring in James O'Connor even? Who knows? We'll have to wait and see. But you know, when you've got really key players and key positions running the show the way Gibson Park and Finn Russell did, it's exciting times from a Lions perspective.
Does go to show as well, just, I mean, it's the most obvious thing in the world, but just how unbelievably important a good pack is, because I don't know, I put a bit of a Scotland tax on Russell and on Jones and on Tuipulotu last week when previewing this game, again clutching at straws, trying to find reasons why the Lions might not be as dominant as we expected them to be. And you're like, well, Scotland haven't been world beaters for the last couple of years, but actually the truth is that they possibly would be if their forwards were as good as those three backs.
And the reality is the front five of Scotland has been a problem for the last number of years. The proper go forward, having major steel in there and particularly the depth behind their initial front five. You know, they have, some nice players, don't get me wrong. And, you know, the likes of Agerson and Cummins is obviously, you know, on the Lions tour and Schoeman, you know, all nice players. But then, you know, when you're bringing guys on after 50 minutes and they just aren't the saying that's where Scotland have fallen down, their strength in depth. And so when you're looking at a three-quarter line of Finn and Hui-Pulutu, as everyone's like to calling him now, you look at what they can do with good possession. That said, I wouldn't say Finn was majestic. I think Hugh Jones is a fantastic athlete, but he'd kill me with the amount that he runs with the ball in one hand tucked under his arm. Like, it's a dream as a defender. It's a trigger, you know, to hit in that someone's not. And you can only get that chicken wing offload. Whereas when he's in open space, you got to run with the ball in two hands a little bit more or switch it from one to the other. He tucks it under that right arm and he goes. And I think he limits his options. That said, I thought the timing of his pass for the Sheehan try was magnificent. Took a beautiful overs and got on the outside. I don't know, it was Ikitao or whether it was Sulihi. But then the timing of it giving to Curry as well, didn't overplay his hand. So some and obviously the no try. I did put my neck on the line in the suite in Portrush and say that was a no try before there was anything contested, because you could tell that the tackle had been completed, and they actually thought I was quite impressive as a pundit for once, which is an anomaly. Some really good, some not so good. I think it's close. I think if Ringrose manages to come off and play really well for 20 or 30 minutes, I think you've got a real conundrum on Andy Farrell's hand, because I would suggest that I know that he's a huge Gary Ringrose fan, big performance against the Brumbies, probably in pole position to start, but then has this injury, has this concussion, and now he's back. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see a couple of changes, and that could be one at 13. It could be. I think you'll potentially see one in the back three. You could easily, and then probably nobody else is changeable, considering the performance of Genge excellent, Furlong very solid, Sheehan really good, Itoje and McCarthy. You could fit Chesham in there and wouldn't lose a huge amount with McCarthy, but you don't want, because it was a big 42 or 43 minutes on the back row. Conan, I kind of only on reflection watching a second time round, super hard yards, exactly what the team needs. Trucking it up off line out, giving them platform, and then the two flankers are outstanding. So I think the only change is probably in reality, other than an enforced one with McCarthy, would be a back three player or two, and 13. That's really all I would envisage.
On the Hugh Jones disallowed try, first of all, congratulations to Ben O'Keefe on improving your street cred at Portrush. Second of all, Owen Farrell, did you see him on camera shaking his head while the entire bench was celebrating? That guy knows his ball.
He does. And, no matter, you got to make sure that you don't get caught up in the emotion of the situation. You play the scenario, and it just looked wrong, didn't it? And people will say, well, he didn't hold him in the tackle. It's very nuanced, where you don't necessarily have to hold someone right to the final end of a tackle for the tackle to be complete. There's maybe a tiny slight grey area between someone not being held in a tackle, but that's where a tackle hasn't been very firm and collision based. It's very scrappy. Someone slides down someone or tap tackle, or just gets a kind of a flailing arm and knocks them to the ground. That's play on. When someone makes a proper tackle but the grasp doesn't complete right to the ground, that is tackle considered complete and over. And that's why the ball has to be placed for it to be picked up and go again. And I don't know, it's very hard to put yourself in Hugh Jones' position. It's a tricky one, because, you can sniff the line, it's right there, but a quick play of the ball and you bounce over. That felt different to a momentum piece of a second motion, didn't it? It was a good decision, as much as the Sulihi decision was a good and easy decision by the time we saw the replays.
Yeah. Can I just ask you a technical question? The analysis piece there on Hugh Jones and his running and his carrying style, I presume he just gets more speed and pace carrying in one arm, does he? And that's why he does it?
But also, he backs himself a lot. And don't get me wrong, he's such a brilliant hole runner, and he breaks a lot of tackles. So he has a lot of good fortune with it. And maybe it's to do with the personnel. That said, he plays with Darcy Graham and Van der Merwe on the wings as well, and King Horn a full back. So it's not like he doesn't have good quality outside him. But I think he's just a player that really backs himself. But if I was defending that and I saw it tucked, I'd be like licking my lips. Right. Whereas someone that is ball playing, with running as hard with the ball in two hands, or switching it from one to the other and looking around, I would say from a vision point of view, there's other players that have stronger vision, but he athletically, he's very, very impressive. You know, breaks the first tackle an awful lot, is quick, is evasive. Like I said, picks those holes magnificently well. And I think that's why he compliments Russell brilliantly, because he just sees that pass. Okay, it's Tupulutu that saw, you know, that ran the line for the first try. That could so easily have been Hugh Jones. We've seen it a million times where they're on this kind of telepathic wavelength, where they see the play unfolding. And so as much as I'm saying maybe has a slight shortcoming in that ball carrying, he has so many uplifts as well, that kind of counter that. So I think it's a real marginal call. It's always going to have been a marginal call between the two. And would you have any problem if they stuck with the tried and tested of what won the first test with the Scottish three-quarter line? Of course not. But whether there's enough in the defensive side of Gary Ringrose, turning that into an attacking weapon, where they feel as though his link play is slightly better than not, we'll have to wait and see for the decision time of the team on Thursday.
Nobody's ever made an unexpected decision with regards to the midfield pairing ahead of a Lions test before.
Never. and the thing is, we are very lucky that you know, even if you put Elliot Daly in the mix, who was unfortunate with injury, like, he, you know, obviously his capacity to have played 13, he was never going to start there, but to be able to go in and fill in at 13, like, you're looking at five very good quality centres. Obviously, Jamie Osborne has come in, but, you know, as a late inclusion. But I think if you look at Bundy and Gary and Hugh Jones and Tupulutu, all very, very good rugby players. And so any of the combinations that were played, if once they clicked, it was going to be very hard to displace them. And no shock horror that it's been the national teams that have tended to gel a little bit better together. And that's what you need. You just need, listen, you know, people could say, and maybe it's not my place to say it, but you look at the combination of Jamie Roberts and Jonathan Davis in the lead up to the Lions tour in 2013, they were, you know, playing really well as a unit. They lost to us in the first game and they won the Six Nations. So, you know, Jamie then getting injured, there is just a cohesion around players that that have played together a lot more. Even with me playing with Jamie 4 years previously, I hadn't played with him again. And so there's a comfort that comes with that when coaches just see the body language of two players that play together regularly and how seamless it might look.
One of the other things that we were clinging to last week ahead of the first test is that Joe Schmidt might just have something up his sleeve, never write a Joe Schmidt team off, etc., etc. Is there any level of disappointment about what they actually brought in terms of how well coached they were, how well prepped they were? Like, I'm sure there's only so much you can do if the playing group isn't there, and a lot of inexperience, especially in that back line. I'm not sure, maybe it was wishful thinking to expect a rabbit out of the hat.
Yeah, I saw Lawrence Dallaglio saying, you know, Joe Schmidt, all the talk about that, well, he's not a magician. And I must say, like, I think some of the plays that he kind of conjured and came up with to try and get in behind, you know, there's only one that really kind of sticks out is that scrum play where Tom Lynott kicked the ball back crossfield. They tried to show they were going blindside. They came back open, kicked across, tried to manipulate Hugo Keenan in the backfield to play blindside a lot more. And with the Lions trying to play a hard four up in defense, they were trying to leave him kind of susceptible. But Hugo's so good at covering that and reading body language and not overplaying his hand too quickly. But he then makes, you know, gets himself in a great position, kind of catches the ball, then spills the ball. But other than that, very little I can think of where, yeah, it was a real Joe Schmittism. A great multi-phase play was something that you could really hang your hat on with him, that he had analysed the Lions and countered with a particular type of play that he felt he could get after them. Very, very little. A few of the tip-ons that had a bit of success when they got a little bit of front football, got in behind, but then I think you need to realize as well, and maybe it was an inexperienced 10, when you get in behind like that, you've got to really play flat to the line. You've got to play super aggressively. And sometimes, you know, you stretch the defense by those players that are realigning. When the ones close to the ruck have difficulty in getting back out to you, you playing flat that way does two things. It gets yourself outside of them, or what it does is when the realization of the player is defending outside, they know that the guys towards the ruck aren't going to get there. They come in and then you have to shift the ball. So for me, they kind of still went through, they made some inroads and then they still went through some multi-phase plays that they'd called beforehand, sometimes just playing heads up. You make it in 2 or 3 meters in behind a team and they're on their heels. You just play direct and physical and that's catch pass. So I was a little bit disappointed with kind of the lack of kind of creativity of exposing Lions' deficiencies that really wasn't that apparent.
No. Is there a factor here as well, Brian, that he's not going to be the head coach for the World Cup and there's like so much new blood coming in? I know there's the pride of trying to put your best foot forward against the Lions, but this guy's not going to be the coach this time next year.
Listen, no one's caring. No one cares about that. Right now, here now, it's about not saving faces. We're trying to win a series, right? That's what they're thinking. They're thinking, how do we turn this around to make it 1-1 going into Sydney? And what can we do to counterpunch a lot of the scenarios that we found ourselves in? And I think they really have to think their way around it, because I don't think they have the ball carrying capacity unless they're going to get some of those aforementioned injured players back in and give them a little bit of that momentum and go forward. I think they're going to have to take a few more risks. I think they're going to have to push the pass. They're going to have to show the skill level that we would associate with good Australian teams and even some not so good Australian teams. For me, they were always the thinking man's team. They always saw it well. I know, knew how to create space, really crisp passers. And Joe, in our time, was always he was obsessed around the ruck and ruck speed and the quality there. I think they got beaten at the ruck. Certainly first half, absolutely beaten out the gate at the ruck. Very little fast ruck ball and very hard to put your attack game into the places you want to put it with 3-4 second rucks, because all defensive systems will align in that time. And so there's two things. You get a little bit more reactive at the ruck, the ball carrier in the fight, the two clear barrels that he talks about left and right, and maybe a security, but then ball gone. And worry about multi-phase calls beforehand. If you get fast ruck ball, you play aggressively to the line. All the best Larkham and Roth and Horan and Gitto and all these guys, when you got in behind, just played aggressively to the line, trying to hold defenders. And they got so many times the ball out to Mitchell and Ashley Cooper and their wingers and Corabetti, purely because they played aggressively, ran with the ball in two hands, whip passes, catch pass. And it looked very, very simple, but incredibly effective. They just need to go back to the simplicity of that. But it starts with fast ruck ball and collision winning. And I just don't know if they have the personnel for that.
Brian, I know you got to go because you got to get on a plane to Melbourne. What is the plan down there? Are you going to be in the bowels of the MCG handing out caps or anything like that?
I don't believe I am. No, certainly there's not. I haven't. There's been nothing in my emails in that regard. No, I
check your junk.
I think that ship has sailed. I'm down with Howden, and I'm hanging out with Gav Hastings and Jason Robinson and Nolly Waterman and Miguel Fonsi and Jamie Roberts. So we'll be there together on game day. I'm going to try my level best to play a couple of rounds of golf as well in one or two of the decent. I'm playing Royal Melbourne on Thursday, so I'm very, very excited about it. And then catch up with pals in Sydney, like Cheka. Obviously lives there, and I know him and his wife Steph very well. And I've got pals from my HSBC days in Hong Kong that live in Australia. Meet up with them. Some of my old teammates, Nathan Spooner and Adam Magro and Owen Finnegan, they've been on talking about catching up. And so yeah, it's a really actually should be a really good 10 days. And I just hope my wife doesn't watch this show.
that's a lot of cups of coffee, Brian. Enjoy that.
Like, I haven't even factored in any jet lag whatsoever into this at all. Like, I'm going to go in there, I'm going to be perfect. So I don't know. We'll see how it all unfolds, because it takes 6 days. My experience is 6 days to properly recover. So that's not going to be till Tuesday of next week. So just in time for me to turn around and come back home. At home. Yeah.
Well, good luck with all of that, Brian. Good to chat to you. Safe travels.
Chat to you down there. All right. Cheers.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Bank of Ireland, a proud sponsor of Irish rugby. Never stop competing. Off the Ball Rugby.
I had him in my original, if you remember, Colin. I had him as my starting 10 for the tour.
Yeah, but you were also in a stadium and that's changed. So, like, what do you think now?
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.